Dark Wraith Publishing presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 2 for Autumn Semester 2013. Lecture 9, delivered on September 18, 2013. The title of this lecture is Ratio Analysis.
Today, Ratio Analysis. In this lecture, which will actually be sort of a dynamic interaction, I'm going to go through a corporation and do the ratios of that corporation with you. And then this will prepare you so that you can do a homework assignment where you'll calculate ratios for another public corporation. And then on the first exam, there will be a public corporation that you'll do some ratios for as well. Along the way, as I told you, finance is not about numbers. It is about what the numbers tell us. So as we are doing these ratios, we won't just calculate ratios and be done with it. I'm going to have you thinking about and answering some questions, interacting with me, about what this means, what this ratio means, what that ratio means. Now, I've given you a ratios sheet, and I also wanted to give you a template so you could just fill out the ratios, but unfortunately I couldn't find that sheet, so you'll just have to do them in your on your notes as we go along and calculate these, and make sure you can do the calculations. And also, another caution along the way, be sure that you know what the units of measure are for these different ratios that we're going to do on this sheet here today. So, without further ado, this is Target, otherwise to people from Decatur known as Target Corporation. And we will be using the interactive data. Oh, there we go. I just did it. We will use the Edgar filing systems system of the SEC, go to the public filings for Target Corporation, Target Corp, and we will filter those by the 10K so that we will have only the 10Ks filed. And one thing I do want to warn you about with 10Ks, they are the annuals. But always keep your eye out. See this little puppy right here, 10KA? Companies will sometimes make a filing, and then they will subsequently make an amendment to that filing. Sometimes the amendment is something technical, some wording, or an error that they made. Other times, it's actually material. So you would want to make sure that if you are using a 10K, a subsequent 10KA was not filed. If it was, you go into it and see if it was something to do with financials. In a case like that, you would probably want to use the 10KA's financials instead of the 10K's financials. That can happen if there is some question about a practice or a procedure under generally accepted accounting standards, and the company went back and redid something to come into compliance or to more accurately reflect something. But in this case, our 10K is fine, so we are going to go to the interactive data. And again, you're going to have other courses where you'll have to use this kind of data, so this is a great resource anyway. And we're going to go to the financial statements. And we're going to prowl through here for a minute to make sure we know where we are. This is annual data right here in the consolidated statements of operations. And I got 3 years of it here. So that's probably going to be one resource that I'll use. I might want to just look around very quickly and see if there's anything else that would be worth looking at for that. Consolidated statements of financial position. Now this is balance sheets. As you can see pretty clearly, those are the balance sheets of the corporation. Primarily, we'll want the income statement and the balance sheet for doing our ratio analysis. Those are the only ones that are really noteworthy to us. I'm going to quickly go through and see if I've got a cleaner set of income statements. Whoops. Meh. Consolidated. That's not going to help. No. Probably my income statements up here will be the ones that I use if I can find them again. There we go. Okay. I kind of don't like this format because you've got this quarterly data, which is useful for comparative purposes for looking at trends and seasonal cycles. But for us, we're just going to use the annuals, and we'll use the current annuals. Now, I'm going to show you something. I'm going to write a formula here on the board for you. It is one that is not... Do I have that on your... Year-over-year change. I'm going to show you something here. I've got the formula there, and I've got another version of it here. A percentage change will always be calculated as the ending value minus the beginning value over the beginning value. And then you times it by 100% because these are percentage changes. End minus beginning over beginning. In finance, and practically speaking, in any kind of a field that you would be in where there would be numbers involved, if you're looking at changes, absolute changes are useless, honestly, compared to percentage changes. So in other words... Okay, my sales went up by $1,000. That's really exciting if my starting sales were $10,000. That's a 10% increase. But if my sales are $1 million, that's a paltry percentage increase. That's why we want to look at percentages, because they allow us to compare apples to apples and across a company's experience or across two companies. So I could look, for example, just to start this ball rolling, if I wanted to see, for example, what has Target's percentage change in sales been year over year from January 29, 2011 on over to February 2003. So the first one I would do is say, all right, what happened to sales from 2011 to 2012? And I want you to do this with me so that you can do these like a boss. If I can learn how to turn on this calculator, okay, here we go. I would have, in that case, the percentage change would be 68,466 minus 65,786. All of that divided by the beginning value of 65,786. And then I'll times that by 100. So my percentage change from 2011, percent change in sales, percent delta sales, delta is our change symbol, 2011 to 2012 is 4.07%. And again, as I had mentioned earlier, two decimal places of accuracy with whatever you give me as an answer on a quiz, on an exam, in a report. Two decimal places after you've made sure that after it's a percentage. If it's a percentage, you round it to two decimal places. Not three, not one. Don't impress me that your calculator can do 13 decimal places. Two is the house rule. Now, wherever you go to work, they'll have a house rule. A lot of them are two decimal places. Some are three, different things like that. Okay, so now sales from 2011 to 2012, we can say rose 4.07%. A little more than 4%. Now let's see about sales from 2012 to 2013. So that would be 71,960 minus 68,466 All of that divided by 68,466. And you will get, and then you times it by 100, 5.10%. So the percent change in sales 2012 to 2013 is about 5.10%. Yeah.
Why are you doing 2012 minus 2013?
It's not minus, it's two.
Oh, yeah. Sorry.
Yeah. I'll do it like that. So in other words, sales rose by about 25%. Does anyone have a problem with me saying that sales rose by about 25%? Do you see that? Let me make sure you see that. If you don't, say, stop, sucker. What are you talking about? Oh, I see. There is a 1% rise. No, there was a 25% increase. If I go from 4% to 5%, I've jumped 1% on a base of 4%. Sales rose 25%. Let me try it again. See if you follow me. See, this is where the average thinker probably would never have done the calculation. But when we are looking at numbers, we look at numbers in a way that other people don't. Even in the news media and the financial media, you'd hear, well, sales rose 1%. Ha, ha, ha. No, sales went up 25% because I jumped 1% on a starting point of 4%. So sales rose about 1 over 4 or 25%. You got it? So it kind of looks like, well, that kind of sucks.com. Actually, a 25% jump in sales is pretty darn decent. Now we go to the next question. Give me the easiest answer, and that's all we'll do. Why did sales go up? What's the easy answer? Talk to me. Why did sales go up? Go ahead.
So more. Oh.
I said easy, not trifling. I asked for that. I know I did. Let's try this again. Madam, why did sales go up? Oh, wait. Jack, are you with me today? Oh, yeah. Oh, Jack always comes through. The economy improved. I know, I'm leading you. I'm being mean here. Yeah, the economy improved a little bit. It's clear that we were still really laboring in that recession in 2011, 2010. By the time we're seeing them moving through into 2012, you were seeing the whole economy beginning to shake off the recession. Now, we're not in a full-blown expansion yet, but almost any business will tell you, yeah, it's better now, and we've seen it better for about a year now. And I can even tell you that from my sales, 2 years ago at the arts festivals, I was dying. I mean, I was not even covering my fees. And this year, oh yeah, you could tell people had money, they were pulling it out of their pockets, they were willing to spend. So that means, first of all, the economy was improving, but also it means consumer confidence was going up. People were willing to spend some of the money instead of holding it in case the zombie apocalypse came. So there you go. But always remember, do check these ratios, but also look for percentage changes in ratios and in the raw numbers as well as we're going along, because that can tell you some things right there, just the percentage changes. Okay, now let's get down to some brass tacks. Gross margin. That's gross profit over your sales. Now, if you look at gross profit, is there a gross profit line here? Cost of sale. Okay. So the problem is here, if you look at this, you have the total revenues being given, and then the cost of sales. But there is no intermediate line in these financials that gives you what the revenue minus the cost of sales is. So we're going to have to get the gross profit on our own. Do you follow what I said there? Remember that your gross margin is sales minus cost of goods sold. If I look on these financials, they don't give that gross profit. They just list the total revenues and then the cost of sales. So we have to do some work here on that. And I just noticed that I ran too fast. I used sales instead of total revenues. Companies use different names for the same thing, and you can sometimes get a little surprised by that. But anyway, what we'll have to do, what I'm going to do is I'm just going to calculate the cost of the two ratios, gross margins, for 2012 and for 2013. So the gross margin, the gross profit for 2012 would be $69,865 minus $47,860. I don't know why Target doesn't give gross margin. That's pretty normal to give. So I've got for 2012 my gross profit. For 2012, what did I say? 22,005. And for 2013, the gross was 73,301 minus 55,68. Oops. 55,68 is 22,733. Okay, so those are my gross incomes. So now I'm going to do some gross margins. And I'll use the total revenue line instead of the sales line on this one. So in order to get the gross margin, you might want to write down how I'm doing that. So to get the gross margin for each of those 2 years, I would take, for 2012, I would take the gross profit, 22,005, and I would divide that by the total revenue, 69,865. And I'll get, and then times it by 100 because it's a percentage. It's a percentage, so times it by 100. So I get a gross margin for 2012 of 31.50%. Make sure you get that.
So is it divided by the total revenue?
I'm doing it by the total revenue this time for this one, yeah.
It's normally sales
left? Well, you see, here's the problem. Most companies will use the term revenue and sales interchangeably. Target, being some new age stuff, it's separating them and making them two different terms for its accounting purposes. So in this case, I got a little caught off guard because I looked at sales and I didn't realize that wasn't the same as revenue for this company. So now I'm coming back into form with the total revenue here. Which kind of is weird, but anyway. Okay, now let me do the gross margin for the next year. The gross margin for the next year would, for 2013, would be 22,733 divided by total revenue, which would be 73,301. It eased back a little bit. The gross margin eased back just a little bit, which would indicate, well, We'll talk about that in a second. I'm going to do a little quick thing here. The percent change in this would be end minus begin over the beginning, which in this case is going to come out to be times 100%. It's going to be a small change, but I'm just a little curious about it. 100% times 100%. So I would get 31.01 minus 31.50, I'm sorry. All of that divided by 31.50. That's about a negative 1.56%. In other words, the gross margin eased back about 1.5%. That's not significant, but it does indicate that they're paying a little more for their inventory as a percent of sales. In other words, in 2013, something that they sold cost them in direct more than it did in 2012. Why would that be? Is there any kind of, like I said, this is a relatively small change. The change is only about negative 1.56. It's not big. But is there an explanation of why that might be, have happened? Why they might be paying, having a little bit more expense? Well, it should be about the same. The inflation, if you're dividing one number by another, the inflation should cancel out from the sales to the, unless they have inflation happening at the cost level that they are unable to pass along at the sale level. There's what I was trying to get at. So in other words, we might be seeing the fact that they were holding the line on their prices a little more than their suppliers were holding the line on prices. Now, if their suppliers' prices are going up relative to targets, is that macroeconomic inflation? Yeah, it might be, but it also just could be a sign that the economy is recovering. Suppliers are trying to firm up their margins, so they might be charging a little more. It also could be the case, you might argue, there are a lot of different arguments, but I'm just showing you how to think. Well, maybe Target is just buying a little bit better merchandise. It's going a little bit higher class than it would have the year before. It's buying stuff that's a little more expensive, and it's not passing the entire increase in expense along to its customers. That would certainly be the case with the groceries that they're selling, because they used to have kind of like this cheap stuff on their shelves, and now they got pretty decent noms on their grocery shelves. But anyway, that's gross, and I'm not going to go through all of these quite that painfully, but let's talk about operating margin, and hope to God these people actually report an operating margin. Look at this. They don't do that one either. God, that rotates my ass. Is there something that they do that's actually in compliance? Give me a second here. Mother of God. I don't remember Target being this much of a pain in the derry rear last year. Do you mean I have to calculate those like I'm an accountant? Okay. I just crashed my computer. You know what? No, I don't care about compatibility view, for God's sake. Stop the script. Well, apparently Edgar's got some kind of a nasty little script going on in there. Oh, no, I don't want a solution to the problem, for God's sake. Okay, let's see this. Financial statements. Okay, I'm just going to have to go back in. Alrighty then. Yeah, okay. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to do just one operating margin for you here. An operating margin here, I'm going to calculate the operating profit, which would be my, and I'll do the operating profit for operating income for 2013. This will be operating income for 2013. This is, in other words, EBIT. Do I have it there? Oh, there it is. Oh, thank God, it is there. Okay. Whew. Okay, so now we're going to do operating margin. For 2012, we would take 5322 divided by total revenue for 2012, which would be 69,865. And then I times that by 100, and I get a 7.62% operating margin. 7.62. Now let me do the operating margin for the 2013, which would be 5371 divided by their sale, or their total revenue, 73301. And you've got times 100%, 7.33%. So we can see that there is a little consistency that probably, yeah, did I make a mistake? No, EBIT. EBIT is operating. Yeah. Am I missing something there? Okay, because I'm trying to translate. No, okay. This is EBIT, operating income. Did I use the wrong column? That's not what I want. I want this one. Earnings before interest and taxes is operating income. Okay. Is that the one I used?
Yeah.
Okay, good. Don't do that. I'm already fighting with my dementia and the voices. Yeah, no, earnings before, no, don't worry about that. Boy, that was exciting. Okay, now, return on assets. Okay. But anyway, okay, by the way, net margin, I also want to do my net margin, which is net income over sales. This is how much of every dollar I sold is available to the shareholders. So the last one that I'm going to do is in these just income statement things. Oh, that's net margin I want to do. And then a net margin. And that's from EBIT, net margin. So I'm going to go down there to the net earnings, which is their fancy way of saying net income. And I'm going to say, all right, for 2012, my net earnings are $29.29 divided by my total revenue, $69,865. And then I times that by 100, and I've got 4.19% net margin. And then for the 2013, I'm going to do net earnings, which are going to be $29.99 divided by the total revenue, $73,301. And that gives me, and then times that by 100, 4.09. So my change in net margin would be end minus beginning, 4.09 minus 4.19 divided by the beginning, 4.19. You notice all the percentages cancel. This is a pure number. 4.09 minus 4.19 divided by 4.19 times 100. So my net margin eased back 2.39%. Not significant. And it probably, almost all of that is coming from that little bit of bump in cost of goods sold over sales. This isn't a lot. But again, what net margin tells you is that in 2012, for every dollar of sales target revenue target had, the shareholders get to keep, either through dividends or reinvestment in the company, a little more than 4 cents. And the same was true in 2013. For every dollar of revenue that Target had, the shareholders got to keep, through dividends or reinvestment in the company, about 4 cents. That's not spectacular. But at the same time, it doesn't suck. The company is profitable, at least on paper, in accounting terms. So that's what that means. Now, return on assets, ROA. ROA, we're going to take the sales divided by the total assets. The net income divided by the total assets. I said sales, net income. So net income, so ROA. So the return on assets, ROA, is going to be net income divided by total assets. So we got our net income. So we got 2012 net income on this company. Net income on this company is going to be for 2012, 29.29. And then we got to go to the balance sheet to find the total assets for 2012. Well, let's keep working here until I find the stupid balance sheet. There it is. Total assets, 46,630. So in other words, 29,29 divided by, what was that, 46,630? 46,630. Equals times 100. This is a percentage. 6.28%. That's 6.28%. Now we're going to do 2013. I'm going to get the denominator since I'm over here on the balance sheet right now. The denominator will be 48,163. Now go back and get the net income back up here. Net income for 2013 is 29.99. So that would be 29.99 divided by 48,163 times 100, 6.23%. Okay, there's the two ROAs. In other words, the assets of this corporation brought a net yield for the year 2013 of 6.23%. You invested in all those assets as a corporation. This is their annual yield for you on that investment. Total assets are your investment. What did they bring you in cash money at the bottom line after you paid all the bills? Well, for 2012, they yielded 6.28%. For 2013, 6.23%. Is that a good number or is that a bad number? The first thing you would say is, well, let's look at industry. But on the other hand, I'm also just going to look at this company and say, well, that's a hell of a lot better than I would have gotten investing in a CD. It's a lot better than I would have, it's actually better than I would have gotten investing in some a lot of other things, because interest rates suck. That's actually not too bad. It's just on a basic level, I'm going to say, okay, I'd have to look at what was happening in the industry, but I can tell you right now, the industry that targets in includes companies like Sears, JCPenney, Kohl's. We're talking about companies that are nearly on their deathbeds. So when I see 6.23%, that makes my heart warm and my pants damp. That's a technical term. So that's what that there's that one. Now we got ROE. In other words, the shareholders, what they have invested, their investment. ROE is net income over shareholders' equity. So in the 2 years, the numerators for those two would be 29.29 and 29.99, and then I can go back into the balance sheet here and get my, if I can remember, see if I hit it. Nope. Really? Come on. This is driving me crazy today. Okay. Shareholders' equity. Go down here. Total liabilities. Okay, total shareholders' investment. They're using some pretty unusual terms. I will make sure that the one that you have for a quiz or an exam uses more standard terminology. But target seems to be kind of new age in the words that it uses. Because that's what they're showing there. That's total shareholders' equity. For 2012, 15, 8, 21. And for 2013, 16,558. And then I can crank those out. 29,29 divided by 15,821. And I get times that by 100. All of these that I've shown you so far are percentages. I get 18.51%. And put somewhere in your notes all percentages in this column, in the profitability ratios. And then what I do is I'm going to go over to the next one, 29.99 divided by 16,558 times 100, 18.11%. I'm not going to do the percentage change. You can see that return on equity has eased back a little bit. Something important, though, here. Why is the return on equity above the return on assets? Technically, it's because the total assets is total liabilities plus shareholders' equity. So you've got to have a larger denominator for ROA than ROE. Okay? But on a more practical level, why is the return on equity higher than the return on assets? Remember that the assets include liabilities and equity. So the equity is blended with the liabilities. Liabilities are safer investments than equity investments. If you invest in bonds, you are avoiding risk that you would have if you invested in stock. And again, if you invest in bonds, you are avoiding risk that exists when you invest in stock. Because the bondholders have to be paid first, their risk is less than the shareholders, who get nothing but what's left after the bondholders are paid. Equity is riskier, and the greater the risk, the greater the Oh, I love it when you talk like that. Dinner tonight, okay? Oh, sorry. that's exactly right. You see, forgive my language here, damn straight ROE is going to be higher. Now, the question is it high enough for the risk of this investment? Again, you'd have to look at what the industry average is, what your tolerance for risk is, of course, obviously, also. But just giving you right off the top of my head, that's pretty darn good. Yeah, you're taking risk investing in a department store, but at the same time, for a return above 18%, you try to get that on a checking account, on a CD. You try to get that on almost any investment. That's a darn good return Target did for its shareholders. The return on equity tells the shareholders, this is what we returned on your money. And at 18%, better than 18%, well, that's darn good. It's sure a lot better than if you had been in JCPenney or in Sears or in Kohl's. Now, I don't want to put Kohl's quite in the same category with JCPenney and Sears, but at the same time, that industry is really struggling right now. Have you been into a JCPenney in the last 10 years? You die of boredom in there. Sears, you go in there and it's like, it's great. It's like your mom and dad's store, but they haven't redecorated it since your mom and dad were born. Kohl's is a little better, but they're actually still struggling too. And they're trying to, I've seen evidence, and I can't tell you this as authority, but I've seen evidence that they're trying to change their business model somewhat. Because it used to be you go into Kohl's and there was always, everything was on sale. This week, 40% off. You go in the next week, this week, 40% off. They had a sales always mentality, and I've seen some effort for them to kind of pare that back so they're not saying everything's on sale every week. Kohl's is trying to fight its way out. It's struggling, though. Target is just cruising compared to some of its competitors these days. So there you are on that. Now, let me go down here, and I'm going to look at a couple of these liquidity ratios. Now, in your book, one of these ratios isn't there. And I'll point that out to you here in a minute. But essentially, here's what we have that both the book and I will show you. The current ratio is current assets over current liabilities. Current ratio is current assets over current liabilities. Now, hear me well when I tell you this, because I might have you answer this question as an essay question. What does current ratio mean? The current ratio simply tells you how many times over their current assets can pay their current liabilities. How many times over their current assets can pay their current liabilities. So if I'm going to calculate that, I'm going to say, all right, I'm going to take the ratio. This won't be a percentage. This will be a factor. So the units of measure are time. So I'm going to take my current assets for 2012, which are $16,449, divided by my current liabilities, which are $14,287, and I get a 1.15. And the units of measure are a times symbol. In other words, this company can pay its liabilities that are due presently 1.15 times over with the assets that are liquidable presently. What can I get money for reasonably soon? Well, that would pay 1.15 times over what could come due reasonably soon. That's a tight current ratio. Now, the next thing is that the reality is that in current assets, one of your current assets if you needed to get money fairly quickly, one of your current assets would probably suck at that. You'd have to sell it at a fire sale price and you would get, oh, I almost heard something I care about. Okay, you probably wouldn't get a whole lot for it. You'd probably have to have some liquidator do it. Inventory, yeah, I can say, well, look at my inventory. It's worth X amount of money. You're not going to get that for it if you need money real quick. That inventory that's listed on, that value listed on your accounting statements, it isn't worth that if you have to get money real quick. You're probably going to have to go to Al's Pawn Shop and sell it, and you're not going to get hardly anything. Okay, now, let's look at the current ratio for the next year, for the most recent year. In that one, where the hell am I? Okay, current assets. Okay, current assets are, for this current year, $16,388, and then we're going to get the current, finish up the current ratios here. $16,388 divided by the current liability, divided by 14031, is that right? Okay, so I get 1.17 times. So they have firmed up a little bit. They're a little bit more liquid than they were before as far as current ratio goes. That's the current. Now let's go to the quick ratio, otherwise known as the acid test. How many times over can they pay their current liabilities with their current assets if we dismiss the value of inventory? So we're going to take the current assets minus inventory this time, divided by the current liabilities. So the current assets will take, for 2012, $16,449, and we're going to subtract out their inventory, $79,18. And then we're going to take that result, $85,031, divided by their current liabilities, $14,287. And now we get a 0.60 for 0.60 times. The acid, if you take out their inventory, they can cover their current liabilities with their current assets only 0.6 times. So they're still hanging out 40% if they liquidate and don't get anything for their inventory. That's a little bit scary right there, but that's the way it is. Okay, so now let's go to our 2013. Current assets, $16,388, minus the inventory, $79,03. And we get $84.85 divided by the current liabilities, $14,031. And again, a 0.60 times. So they're stable on this. But it's a little scary because this is a company that is heavily invested in inventory. It's clear that that inventory is carrying a lot of the weight of their current. And now for the one that's not in your book, one of the old school ones that we did back in the day, and it's still done by good financial analysts now. It's called the burn test. If the zombie apocalypse comes, are you going to be able to call someone and sell your inventory? Probably not. There's zombies at the door. Okay, are you going to be able to call someone and sell your accounts receivable? Probably not. There's zombies at the door. What I'm saying to you is there's zombies at the door. That means that only the money in your pocket is what you got for NOS. So when you get in, when we get in our truck, you know, we have the grids on the front, we're knocking over zombies going to Burger King. All that matters to Burger King is the money in your pocket. Okay? The burn ratio says if it came down to the company having to satisfy its current liabilities right now. All that would matter is the money that is there that they can get their hands on. Not their inventory, not their accounts receivable, not all the other pretty things on the current asset side. Just money matters. So I look for cash and marketable receivables. In this case, Target calls it cash and cash equivalents in short-term investment. In other words, money they can get their paws on immediately. In 2012, that was $79,794. And we divide that by the current liabilities, $14,287. And that is 0.6 times. The burn ratio is 0.06 times for 2012. And in 2013, cash had fallen, 784, divided by your current liabilities, 14031. Again, 0.06 times. They could pay only about 6% of their current liabilities with the cash that's in the bank. In other words, this is a company that does not keep a lot of liquidity, high degree liquidity on hand. So that means that this is a bad company? No, it's a judgment call. It's a management financial decision. You've got $1 million, okay? Should you keep $1 million in your pocket? Yes, you will be impressive. I mean, people say, whoa, look at that. You know what? What's the problem with that? Aside that your pants are going to sag like you're in some bad video. What's the problem with that? Huh? Why not? Well, I mean, geez, you can get noms all day. Sure, that's practical. I would. Damn, there are catalogs. There's the internet. Amazon.com's open 24/7. Safer? Well, yeah, I mean, it is kind of rough out there. But I can buy myself an AR-15, you know, and go to movies in Aurora. Too soon? Too soon? Yes, too soon. You could put that in the bank and invest it. You could put it in assets that earn money. You see, one of the things about companies that have massive amounts of cash, when I see burn ratios that are huge, I think to myself, in technical terms, you dumbasses. Is that the best you can do with cash? Is to keep it where you can get your hands on it for a zombie apocalypse? Why aren't you putting it in investment? Why aren't you putting it in your assets so it can earn revenue? Why aren't you in buying other companies? Why aren't you doing something with it? You see, if that burn ratio is high, I'm a lot more bothered than if that burn ratio is very small. Because with a high burn ratio, that's telling me they don't have any ideas about what to do with their cash, other than just keep it under the desk in the petty cash drawer. So a low cash is not a bad thing. A very small burn ratio is not an evil thing. I see companies, there are some of these famous companies that all these investment analysts say are great investments. They're just swimming in cash. Well, for me, two things. One is they're not doing something with it, so it's not earning any money for their investors, for their shareholders. And second of all, they're sitting around holding that cash so that they can do hostile takeovers. In other words, you don't have any good ideas left in your company, do you, Google? Do you, Apple? Do you, all of those companies that are waiting with all this massive amount of cash that they've been hiding offshore so that they don't have to pay any taxes in the United States? Oh, yeah, they're great ideas because they're going to go buy some of their competitors. Well, that's kind of a stupid thing because that means that they don't have anyone in their own company that can do a new product anymore. If you look at Apple's, have you seen Apple's new iPhone? whoa, that looks just like the iPhone 4 and the iPhone 3 and the iPhone negative 20. Yeah, you see, a high cash reserve, that's a non-innovator. So I'm okay with a company that does this. Again, what I'm trying to show you is how financial analysts think, how we think about companies. We don't think just the numbers. We think what the numbers mean. Now, what I'm going to do here is I want to go real quick through one, these asset activity. Don't worry about average collection period. Just put a little star that, you know, the collection period, that's something that we can talk about in a more advanced class. But one thing that I do want to bring up to you is debt to total assets. This can catch you. And I'm not sure I'm going to be able to catch it here on Tarjay. Okay, debt to total assets is essentially a measure of leverage. How much of the company, how much OPM, how much other people's money is this company using? So I have to find the debt of the company. And I'm going to go down into the liabilities, and I'm going to look under long-term liabilities. Unsecured debt and other borrowings, non-recourse debt, and credit card receivables. This is kind of a difficult thing. Look up here. And I won't make it this hard on an exam or a quiz because Target is showing things all over the place. But you see up here in the current liabilities, you see some unsecured debt and borrowings up here. There's exposure to debt right here, serious exposure. There's also some non-recourse debt that they collateralized with their credit card operation. I'm going to include that too. That's debt that they owe somebody. That's a creditor that could shut them down. What I'm looking for is who could take them to into bankruptcy. So I'm looking here, okay, I've got in 2012 this unsecured debt that's kind of uncomfortable. 3036, and I'm going to add to that this non-recourse debt that they got backed by their credit card operations. I'm going to add the 750 there. And then I'm going to go down here, and there's this exposure that's long-term. That's long-term debt, 13,447. And then I'm going to look around and see, well, they got some more of this non-recourse debt right here, 250. And so I've got an exposure to debt and quasi-debt instruments for 2012 of about $17,483. And you could argue on some of this, well, is that really debt? Does that belong in the debt-to-asset ratio or not? And that's why on an exam or a quiz, I would give you a company that's much clearer in the way it discloses. But let's take that one and let's divide that by the total assets, 46,630. And I get a 37. Now, debt to total assets, you can times that by 100. 37.49. Debt to total assets is, what did I say, 37.49%. In other words, about 37.5% of this company, of this company's total capital structure, is debt. Now, just to do it for the next year, just to see if their leverage has gone up or down or stayed about the same, I would do the same work. I would say, okay, I use unsecured debt at 1494. I would add to that the non-recourse debt plus backed by credit cards in the short run. That's 1500. I would add to that their unsecured long, 14,654, And then I would add, they got rid of all the long-term non-recourse that was backed by credit cards. So I've got 17,648. And I'll divide that by the total assets for 2013, 148,163 times 100, 36.64. Interestingly, Target has backed away from debt in its capital structure just a little bit, but it's enough to be noticeable that they're moving more towards an equity company and less towards a debt-structured company. Last one that I want to do here for today is the times interest earned. Important ratio. Times interest earned, we're going to go back to the income statement, and all you do for times interest earned is take the interest expense divided by EBIT. So for the 2 years, I'll do 866 divided by 5322. 856 divided by 5322. I'm just testing you, yes. 6.22. Okay. Times interest earned. Now what this means, and there's an important thing on this, that will be for a quiz or an exam. For 2013, times interest earned was 6.22 times. And this is a times unit, times unit. One of the things that I ask on quizzes or exams is, what are the units of this ratio? And so that's a quick thing that can catch you if you don't know it. Now, interest expense for the next year, 5371 divided by 762. Survey says 7.05%. Now, what this indicates to you, how many times over is the money that is there to pay interest, can you pay the interest? In 2012, Target could pay its current interest payments 6.22 times over. In 2013, Target could pay its interest payments a little more than 7 times over. Why this is important? If you don't make an interest payment, you're done. You are in default. And that's when the creditors come in. So in other words, I don't want to be this ratio to be less than 1. Because if it is less than 1, I am automatically shut down unless I can get a court to protect me. Because you have to pay your bills. Now, if that thing is way up there in the sky, I'd probably be saying, well, you know, you could pay more interest. You should have a little more debt in your capital structure, maybe. Because you've got so much excess money at the EBIT line, you might want to consider getting a little more debt. But remember the point, though, that if you can't pay that interest payment, in other words, if in times interest earned is below 1, the bottom line is that the creditors have the power to shoot your dog, to sell your Bible on Craigslist, and to make your mother wear furry costumes that please them. You don't ever want to please your debt holders that much. So keep that times interest earned above 1. That's all I have for you. I thank you.